working?
There's no. Yeah, she's working fine. Huh?
Well, anyway, the Spring 41, you recall, found us in the middle of the Yukon area,
right,
over at Ruby.
Riverboat trip.
Yeah, down the riverboat. We wound up at Ruby with on the old Civil Aeronautics airfields on the Yukon and the Kuskokwim. Prior to that time, all there were was very short and rough bush trips. And they wanted to get transport airplanes into the interior, so the way to do that was to build some airfields. So there was tremendous press to get traffic moved, and so there was some of the old famous hands was in the area there. Oscar Winchell, the 211W, one of his favorite Stinsons, and a lot of Jim Dodson out of McGrath, and then of course all the luminaries of the flying world use McGrath as a hub because of the range of the airplanes and weather problems.
Did you ever meet that Radabaugh or whatever his name was?
Radabaugh, out of Fairbanks? No, but I'd read of him. I had accounts of his. Jimmy Radabaugh in the railroad. I'd heard of him for years. Yeah. But anyway, since the only way to go was by dog team or by riverboat or airplane or the Alaska Railroad in case you travel from Seward to Fairbanks, it was obvious that the airplane was the answer, so it followed in 1941 when the survey crew shut down the McGrath area in the fall. I went to Anchorage and went to the old Lars Larson, the Larson Flight School there on the Merrill Field. And Dick Miller was chief flight instructor, and 4498. He's an old Kelly Field military pilot, went civilian instructor. He taught all kinds of people to fly. There were about 20 of us at that time. And just the other day I saw one of the two that are left out of the whole pack, and that's Ward Gay.
Was that right? Ward Gay learned to fly when you were flying.
Uh-huh.
Well.
Sierra Mone when I
Yeah.
I said, hey, Ward, you know something? I was out in his hangar. He said, what? He said, you and I are the only two left out of that whole batch of 20-some guys that learned to fly. Started out in 41. He said, well, they didn't all get wiped out, but almost all of them.
Yeah.
They went to military careers. Anyway, so February 4th, 42, I come up with a bright, shiny, new, inexperienced private pilot's license on Merrill Field. And then I shipped out immediately within a day or two from McGrath again to continue on the surveys of the Kuskokwim and the Yukon.
Did you have any unusual, anything unusual happen while you were learning to fly?
No, except I had two or three engine failures, which was due to carburetor ice. No, there was carburetor ice problems with this old J5.
But I mean the actual.
But
the
I got pretty good on forced landings.
Yeah.
Oh, well, later on I've had.
I mean, it wasn't one of these playthings where the instructor pulls the power back.
No, the engine had quit and the prop had stand still. There's no way to start it because you hand propped them. It was an old J5 with
that. Well, is that right? So you had to land. I mean,
But I got by all those okay. It improved my landing technique.
Yeah.
Anyway, later on, I while in McGrath, there was a light aircraft over there, and I flew that some for 5 or 6 hours during the summer. But people were so busy, you didn't have time to do anything. We was working more than 10 hours shift, and So I decided in the fall of 42, during this time, I might say, this E.I. Clancy, he was the engineer, he got one deferment on top of another. I don't recall whether it was 3 months or what, but I told him I don't want another deferment. I want to go join the Air Force. And he said, what do you want to do? Well, I said, I like to fly fighter planes, or at least fly something. And so he said, well, you know, there's tremendous press for passenger space. How are you going to get back to Anchorage? And we were in the progress of the north-south runway on McGrath at the time on the survey. Well, Clancy, he was quite a joker. He took off for Bethel one day and he says, now I'm going to leave this whole thing under your supervision. I said, but I don't know enough to run it. he says, well, here's the quarters buildings layout, and I want you to survey this sewer line. And here's the fresh water system, and I want it surveyed in this manner. And since I'm going to be gone for three to four days in the Bethel area, and I have to have somebody here in command of this. Well, I said, I'll do the best I can, but all I know how to do for sure is run levels. He says, hey, that's what I want you to do.
Let me ask you, Don. This was obviously gone to the university to learn how to do your surveying.
Yeah.
When did you go there?
39-40.
Is that right? You came from Talkeetna to the university?
Yeah.
At the first year you were up here?
Yeah. I learned two things at the University of Alaska. A little bit about surveying and how to make homebrew in a bathtub.
Yeah.
But,
that's great. That's great.
But anyway, this came in handy over at Ruby because they were desperate for anybody that knew anything. That included me, which is I knew very little, but anyway, I could run levels, and I do general survey work, and finally, I was running a crew around, and there's some very precise surveying. See, we work to plus or minus a tenth of a foot, which is about normal, but the thing is, there was a lot hinged on the accuracy of the final outcome. Of course, you could always check your notes, but you didn't have time to redo every piece of work three times either. For instance, when you lay out the towers, they really have to be laid out. The Eklutna Tower project, every time I go by that, that was one of the projects I was on. Hmm. Now, the engineers, they did all the brain work, but I ran the levels and swung the tangent angles on some of that in my manner. And it wasn't all wrong because those towers still stand.
Sure.
And anyway, at McGrath, I should happen upon an acquaintance, and his name was Lars Johnson. And Lars Johnson was in the Air Force, small contingent of Air Force at McGrath. And he said that he had a C-47 military aircraft going to Anchorage. And I said, but how about the weather? And the weather was terrible. There was a tremendous storm that had been in the area for about 3 weeks, and it had piled 4 or 5 feet of snow and just one secondary storm on top of another. I says, when does it leave? He says, tonight at 10 o'clock. I said, oh boy. And all the other aircraft was lined up there, all the bush aircraft that couldn't negotiate that terrible weather. So C-47, he got me a ride on it. This is Lars Johnson, later the head of the Department of Aviation in Anchorage. And we run the North Coast for years for the off-airways survey. That's within the last 10 years. But this is, we're talking about the fall of 42. So I said, well, do you think that C-47 will make it to Anchorage? Because I knew the weather was terrible. And he said, you bet. He said, they got two of the best flyers in the Air Force flying that thing, and it's got to get through. And they had a priority cargo, but only 4 passengers and myself. So I took my big wood sleeping bag, and that was the only thing that kept the 5 of us from freezing to death, because we had to go to 22,000 feet. That was my first experience with high altitude, no oxygen. We climbed higher and higher and higher, and we finally got descent to 22,000 feet. And it's,
I didn't realize the C-47 looked that.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. No sweat. Anyway, we was trying to get over the weather. We got caught two or three times, and they tried to climb higher and higher and higher. And anyway, as I recall, this wood sleeping bag came in handy to keep the five of us from freezing to death.
How about the oxygen? Did it get to you?
By golly, we didn't have any oxygen except for, a walk-around bottle, but the pilot's is on straight oxygen, of course. Anyway, we finally made it to Anchorage. It wouldn't do to print who the other passengers on the plane were. Actually, they were...
Well, here again, you can scratch it out of the...
Playboy types that had fallen astray in the alleyways of McGrath. And I didn't know whether I wanted to contaminate my wood sleeping bag or not, but we were all freezing, so I just zipped her wide open, and we all got under this 90 by 90 wood sleeping bag. But the thing was, then I got to Anchorage, and I volunteered, and I, of course, have my shiny new private pilot's license in my pocket, and I have
kept... How many hours did you estimate you'd flown by the time you get there?
Oh, not too many. Probably about 50.
Is that right?
Well, yeah.
That's with your license total, or...
Well, that would be long time.
Long time.
Yeah.
Well, how many hours did it take you to get your license?
Oh, wait a minute. I think... Oh, well, it took 40 hours.
Yeah, it was the same regular.
Yeah, the same as now. Uh-huh. Anyway, I had about 10 hours on top of that, most of it in McGrath.
Yeah.
Anyway, I shipped off to the West Coast. There was a big Air Force center on the West Coast. And there were 60 of us to qualifying examinations. They IQ test everybody and qualify and test everyone. And so there were 60 of us. And we hoped to go to CPTC, that's Civilian Pilot Training. That would be...
Civilian Pilot Training Program.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. And about that time, Rommel in Africa was just shooting the Holy Mother out of everything we had. And they decided that we needed bomber support and not fighter pilots or our liaison types. We needed firepower to eliminate the fuel supplies in the depots. Later they needed them.
Yeah.
But right for then, for this particular 60, some major came in and said, "Boys," he says, "we've got a little detainment, but here's what it is. We're going to run this whole crew of 60 that have all qualified through B-17 gunnery school." And everybody said, "Oh." So,
and I bet that would be a blast if a guy wanted to be a pilot and then figure, man, you're going to be sitting up in the tail end of one of those.
Yeah,
things, you know,
that's exactly where I wound up. Was in the tail of the B-17. Anyway, down to Kingman, Arizona, and through all kinds of exhaustive engineering, the gunners, they'd pick out some likely gunners and run them through engineer school. That would be for the specification number was 748, as I recall, which meant that he was qualified as a mechanic for engines and to troubleshoot hydraulic systems and electrical systems. So I got through that okay. And everybody got past the gunnery, most of them did, okay. And boy, in just a short order, we was in England.
Where was it you were training, though? Where was your base?
Kingman, Arizona.
Kingman.
Yeah, and Amarillo, Texas. Okay. And Rapid City, South Dakota, and away we went.
Hmm.
Anyway.
How long did period of that travel?
Oh, not very long.
6 weeks?
No, well, it's more like No. It was to be too many places and doing too many things. I think probably about 6 months. Because it was an exhausting deal.
Yeah.
Well, if, because all these, everybody didn't go to all these electrical, hydraulic engine schools and everything.
Yeah,
but
right.
But a certain part of every crew did. And the rest of them are just gunners. But anyway, I had a 748 rating, but that wasn't flying them. So anyway, then we arrived in England. We flew over in the airplane we got shot down in. On our sixth mission over Bremen, Germany, we got a direct hit on number one engine, see they're numbered from the left to the right, and four on the extreme right wing. And it set that whole wing on fire, and I'd seen lots of planes go down. So immediately, I checked the intercom, and it'd been shot out too. And then our buzzer system, when it rang, you were supposed to bail out. At any rate, the buzzer never, we never got the word to go. The buzzer didn't. And in the meanwhile, the wing's burning off.
Gee.
So about that time, we get a direct hit on number three. And it,
this
up
was
in the spinner section. Yeah, 88 millimeter. It was tremendous. It was cutting holes, red hot, smoking holes through the plane while you'd watch it. Anyway, number three engine ripped itself out by the roots. So we're in trouble. You have all that flat plate about 9 feet in diameter facing forward, tremendous drag on the airplane. The engine jerked itself out by the roots. I think they got a spinner governor hit or something, and the propellers run away when they tore the engine out by the roots. But anyway, we complete, amazing. And we're on fire on number one, number three's gone, and down we go. And we're at 30,000 feet to start with. And the pilot, Lyle, and co-pilot, Mann, finally got the thing more or less straightened out so they could almost steer it, but not quite. And it would swing right, swing left, raise, lower. It's a directional problem. The trim tabs is shot out, I suppose. Anyway, we got staggered over all the shipping, and still burning, still smoking. And I expected that to explode, and then we're too low. During this time, we had a short interval of time before we went into violent maneuvers when we could have bailed out. But when we got into these tremendous high G maneuvers, you couldn't bail out. You would be glued to the side or wherever, or the top or the bottom, or by the G forces of the pull and the turn and the dive. Anyway,
how do you bail out of one of those tail engines?
Well, there's an escape door. I had to hatch off the thing as soon as I saw we got a big hit on the number one engine. But anyway, we're staggering along, and there's some cliffs. Dover Cliffs is the one we usually
were. You got back to England.
Yeah. We got back just by the skin of our teeth over the shipping, the mass of the ships and everything, and we was lined up on this darkey field. A darkey field is a directional finding field, long range ADF, see? And that's what we was homed in on. It had a more powerful or more suitable signal than our own station at Snetterton Heath. But anyway, the two pilots, Lyle and Mann, decided to land straight in at this fighter field where the darkey station homed them in on, see? I don't know, it was tremendously short, but we would have made it. It was a grass field. Would have made it, except there was five Spitfire airplanes came right over the top of us and landed.
Gee.
Right in front of us. And we'd have wiped all five of them out if we'd have landed, because they landed in formation, all out of gas, back from a mission. All just packed
were just
in there.
The light.
Well, so anyway, they pulled up with this smoking engine and a crumpled wing, and the big flat plate on the right, and the plane stalled out and went into the English oak trees. And they say the English oak trees have as much root in the ground as they do tree on the top. The one we hit was about 9 feet in diameter, right on the nose, and it went clear through and cut the main spars of the B-17's wings and scrambled everybody in the process. Yes. Broke the airplane in half.
Jesus, that must have been one hell of a concussion when I hit with you in the back end of that thing.
Well, I didn't stay in the back end. I knew it was going to do something radical, because the plane shuddered and shook, and it was a tremendous airplane, and just thrashed its way through the sky. But anyway, I took two bags of these old sheepskin B-4 bags. I sit on one, put the other back of my shoulders against the center bulkhead right after the ball turned. And
you were out of the tail section.
Yeah, I got out of there. Yeah, right. I didn't. Because you'd be trapped in there. Anyway, the plane broke right in half, and I was looking down in about 30 feet of space when the thing resolved itself up on its nose and off to one side like that.
Gee.
Broke right in half, and I...
Didn't hurt you?
No. Gee. I got down, and I just bailed out.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was going to explode. Boy, it... anyway, the... First thing I saw was, you see, when we hit hard, and all the parachutes in the whole plane opened up.
Is most that of right?
It. Yeah. Boy, this concussion was tremendous.
That was a mess.
Oh, Christ, all blood and oil and guts. And anyway, there was one little lad, a little Polish lad, that always wanted to be an engineer, but he turned out that he was just a gunner for a short time, and then they shipped him out. So he always used to like to trade off and sit on this in the command position of the upper local turret behind the two pilots and watch the pilots.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was where he was at when we hit. And that was a bad place to be, because this big 9-foot English oak tree, like a skewer, come right through the center of the plane. Navigator Kellogg. First thing I did was rush around. I heard a strange noise and the sizzling and all, and I went around to the front of the plane, and it was wiped about 30 feet out under the number two engine. And here was the Kellogg, the Navigator, underneath the number two engine, broke it back, and the engine right. Couldn't have put it more squarely on him. But anyway. The whole plane, he just got crushed underneath the.
Yeah.
But he was still kicking, but not for long. Anyway, then it wiped out Lyle, and it manned the co-pilot. He threw him in the seat, and the whole works about 40 feet up ahead off to the right. You're just a big pile of junk up there, but it wiped out 4 out of 10, and the co-pilot was ruined for life, because he hit so hard his bones were pulled away from his muscles. But anyway, this is just to give you an explanation of a B-17 crash.
What kind of engines do they have?
Well, it was two-stage. They were, wait a minute, no, I think they were Pratt & Whitney's, and they weren't the R2800s, they were the 1200 series, the 2800, 1200 series, yeah. Well, they was.
Well, I just put 12 in series.
Yeah. Anyway, so we had a big military funeral. See, there's four left out of crew, four gone out of crew of 10. Well, anyway, disgusting sidelight would be that it's a very pompous occasion, of course, very 4 out of 10. And naturally, all the colors in the Air Force puts on a pretty good show. The only thing was, a bunch of Yardbirds put on a pretty good show too. They started almost before the thing was over, bouncing big rocks off the coffins. He sent everybody into shock.
What the heck did they do that?
Well, it's just a bunch of Yardbirds come dancing, playing, and horsing around out there and starting to cover over the caskets before we even got out of there. Very disgusting. It made you wonder if you were really getting shot at for real.
Right.
At any rate, listen, there's too many. I wouldn't.
No.
There's more good subject material than that to talk about.
Oh, yeah, right. Don't.
You know, over there, there was a lot of innovations. The V-1 was a terrible psychological weapon.
That German rocket.
Yeah. And they found out that the way to stop a V-1 wasn't to shoot it down, because it caused such a tremendous explosion that the plane following chase would go down with the tube. So they got to where they'd tip over the gyro by. Good hot fighter pilot could put his wingtip under the stub wing of the rocket and tip it over, upset the gyro, and it'd crash.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Holy man.
And this happened on several occasions.
Jeez. Well, how are those things detonated?
Well, on impact.
Jeez, the guy wouldn't want to get any pin of that nose, would he?
Well,
but it might not be that terrible.
It's a wonder that the Germany didn't develop sooner or more of them. They nearly wiped out England with the V-1. Then, of course, I was in Trafalgar Square when the first V-2 hit. And my God, it wiped out a solid block of stone masonry and just pulverized everything, and people run for blocks in all directions, all cut to pieces from flying glass. See, Coventry was a place that they bombed heavily in about 40. Before we got really involved in the war, but they just leveled that place night after night after night. Now, Coventry must have been a manufacturing center, but anyway, part of London. But I went through there, and I bet to this day they haven't got the thing rebuilt. Just flattened the whole country. But anyway, I'm talking about innovations. I want to mention the flak suit, the 27-pound flak suit. It was made like a coat of ancient mail, and it would stop low velocity velocity missiles and fragments of 88 millimeter and slower velocity projectiles crashing through the air. But anyway, this demonstration was to take a helmet. They had helmets of various materials. This particular new helmet was made of a new material, a very tough alloy sandwiched together, and this demonstration was to take a .45 and someone that was a good shot, and then empty the .45 at the helmet at about 30 or 40 feet, and then just be a bunch of dents in it. Of course, then the flak suit.
What about the head that was in that?
The concussion would get you. Yeah. Anyway, the demonstration went along, and so everybody felt secure. And then shortly thereafter, the radio operator in one of our wing planes didn't answer the checkout. And they got to looking around, and you need to talk to the radio, you know.
Yeah.
And, he went in there, and he was wearing his new flak hat, and it was a hole about as big as a baseball in one side and out the other. So small wonder that he wasn't doing much talking.
Yeah.
It was a super high velocity nearby explosion that wiped him off. But anyway, he was required, if possible, to fly 25 missions, see, in in Europe as a crew member. But we went through two airplanes and seven missions. Now the second crash didn't wipe anyone out, but it destroyed the airplane completely. And we was on another Ruhr Valley flight, and we got some severe hits in the Bombay area. It also wiped out the landing gear mechanism.
Now, Bremen was in the Ruhr Valley.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they have the professors over there running all those tremendous flak batteries. But the thing was, when we come back after the big rain, we apparently got one gear all the way down and the other gear was up and locked, but indicated down. So the new pilots came in and they went and set her down, and it just did a tremendous configuration of whiffer deals all over the aerodrome. And it wound up upside down in a borrow pit revetment, and just a big bunch of junk. Anyway, during these violent maneuvers when your airplane's thrown around, why, you generally hurt somebody, and there was several of the crew members made the hospital on that, but nobody got killed.
This probably sounds like a stupid question, but when you're actually there in one of these things, when one of these airplanes is oscillating and...
Holy Christ!
What's it like? I mean, just, you know...
Well, it's just like being in a ball mill and noisy. Those big airplanes never do stop. They just crash and they ring your ears and move some more and roll some more and violent abrupt stops. And
are you aware of any pain, jarring, bruising? Was it all over some
It isn't over too quick. In both crashes, there was pieces that seemed like falling for 3 or 4 minutes.
Hmm.
Well, that's a true statement, but it just seemed like the damn thing would never get stopped. It's so heavy, and those B-17 weighed tons and tons and tons. You get all that momentum going someplace, and you try to stop it, and the pieces are going to keep going.
Of course, I suppose we have weight protection.
Yeah.
Bulkheads are heavy enough so they can hide you in the room, but that hasn't gone in yet. It's a bad feature.
No, but anyway, now let's... get on with the thing here. I had the option of going to the South Pacific or to go to African theater.
This was after you're done in England.
Yeah, but...
what year was it?
44. Now we're into 44. Anyway, I had the 25 missions in and rode two airplanes down, and on the seventh mission we got rid of two B-17s. But then what usually happened was that in the case of our original crew, four was wiped out to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other crew members would get scattered among the other crews.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they do that would maybe sick leave would catch somebody, or somebody would get caught down on Piccadilly Circus or something, and maybe somebody would be AWOL, and it wasn't long before you just got amalgamated among the other crews. So there was only a couple of us from our original crew that finished, and we never, after the seventh mission, after losing two airplanes, you get replaced into other, integrated in other crews, you see. So we didn't...
But normally, if nothing happens to your original crew, you stay together all the way through the mission.
Yeah, you try to, because you get to working together.
Sure,
and,
you bet.
And, but anyway, they had a great system there. And they patch up the pieces and put the wreckage together, and then we get out there and fly them some more. But there's sure some memorable things about England. One of them was when they got to in late 44, after, well, in July, I had in August 44 had all the missions. And it was desperate for an engineered tail gunner one day, so I went on one more mission. And that particular day, we got hit by four FW-190 German fighter planes. And yeah, a big round engine like a P-4. Heck, they had a big round engine. See, now a Messerschmitt 109 had an inline engine.
Bent fuselage.
This is FW-190.
Oh, that was a Stuttgart.
No, this is a fighter plane.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, four of them just about wiped us out. But they got two B-17s out of 12, and that's pretty damn poor shooting from the gunner's standpoint of view. However, this was the best the old Luftwaffe had. They had a regular pattern. They'd hit the lead here, and then they'd sometimes go in 12 o'clock high on the high. The lead, the high, and Purple Heart corner flying low.
Yeah.
And they'd work on the high. They'd do a big split S turn and come in maybe 6 o'clock high on the lead. And then they'd peel off and work on the Purple Heart corner. See, there'd be three flights of four B-17s each, 12 made an element, a wing. And the firepower, if everybody did what he was supposed to do, was, in theory, everything was covered. Later, when they got the ball turrets, that covered an area because they used to come up under those B-17s,
yeah, right,
just shoot them in half. But the chin turret on the B-17Gs was a big help, too. And then they had a thing called an upper local turret right behind the pilot seat, and that was pure dynamite. And then they, of course, had the waist guns and the tail guns. So, and they're twin 50 caliber machine guns with 3,000 yard range. And armor piercing bullets. Quite a show to see those.
What did it sound like when the slugs from a fighter hit the plane?
Oh, well, these, on this 26th mission, I had a good demonstration of what the 20 millimeters sound like. Even with your helmet on and your oxygen mask on, we got the top of our tail shot off. And
you were in the tail gun.
Oh man, I just about, you see, you didn't dare burn out your barrels, yeah, or your guns would freeze up. You give them short bursts, maybe 4 or 5 second bursts. Chop it off, and he'd get closer and closer, and his cannon on his wings would be lit up like Christmas trees.
You're,
and you see the big flashes and hear it, boom, 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 boom. And they had proximity fuses on the 20 millimeter, and then they had impact fuses on some of them. But they had time fuses, and as he moved in on you, this particular deal was time fuses because there was white flashes as his 20 millimeters blew up. And then we got hit right on the top of the rudder, and Jesus nearly deafened me, and the place was full of smoke. And I did my best on this FW-190. Boy, he got within a point blank range, and the tracers were just going, that dip, 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 dip. They're tremendously armored, see.
Yeah.
And boy, I put a lot of pressure on him.
They didn't get him.
Oh, well, he rolled over in big smoke.
So he did smoke.
Yeah, but we was closed up tight with the other four planes, so we didn't know whether I got him or our wingman got him. But between the two of us, we put him down in smoke. But he couldn't have helped but had some severe trouble, because I must have got rid of 500 pounds of ammunition there within a matter of a few seconds. And right on.
Yeah.
Boy, my sights was lined up. Yeah. They had these rad, floating rad sights. Yeah. Well, those were for the turrets. And then they had the rad sights like I put on my wolf hunting gun out in the wolf house. At a certain distance, the fighter plane covers a certain
scale for objects.
It's stadia distance type thing. At a certain range, if he fills half of the radius, starts shooting.
Yeah.
And if he gets any closer than that, why, time your burst and try to get him down.
Yeah.
But boy, I could see my tracers. They shoot a little higher.
Yeah.
And they aren't just like it. Boy, they really had some armor on that thing, and I really tested it. But anyway, then I had the option of, we had, I don't know how many hundred holes, most of them 20 millimeter holes.
Was the rudder still functioning? Was the rudder still functioning?
Yeah. Did you ever see the picture of the B-17 that's practically shot in half by the tail and still made her back? I've got it in one of my collections. But anyway, the thing was, everything considered, it's a wonder a guy'd even make her for 26 missions. Some of them went several missions, some of them...
Jesus, that was just an extra mission for you.
Yeah. But anyway, we'd seen Messerschmitt 109s, but we'd never been hit by FW-190s before.
Oh, those are the bulk wolves.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. That Messerschmitt was the F-109s. Yeah. No, the 190s.
Oh, Messerschmitt 109.
109.
The
that's
long
right.
Long engine.
ME-109s and the FW-190s.
Uh-huh. But the thing was, it was a miracle that we was able to resolve the German war machine, but it could have went the other way too. What a horrible thing that would be. They had England
more reason you want.
bled to death even before it started.
Right.
But they didn't know it.
I know it.
Anyway, so they asked me if I wanted to go to any of these places, and I said, no. I'll stay here and on the gunnery range and shoot movable base skeet and be a skeet instructor. They said, that's what you want to do? I said, yeah, fine. So I run this movable skeet.
I used to shoot registered skeet competition down below.
What was your scores?
Oh, I shot AA for about a year.
Yeah, well, 96. I'll tell you, if anybody shoots enough skeets, you get pretty good. You just
It's just
almost just
absolutely different. You know, you can a little variation there. You don't know really where the birds are.
You
do after a while. You get pretty close. But,
yeah. Well, anyway, you just know when. Just point. Don't look point.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, then in 45, they resolved the Japanese deal and everybody's going to go home. So I had a pretty good stake. And I had saved it with the objective of buying a couple of new airplanes. So I went direct to the Piper factory, and Jake Miller, who's still sales manager, is there, and I asked him what the chance of buying two new Cubs. I wanted a PA-12 and a J-3. And he says, well, we'll put you down on this list. And I said, brother, that looks like the New York telephone directory. And they had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of orders for new planes. A J-3 sold for $1,980. Brand new, complete with the yellow paint, and the lightning jag on it.
Yeah.
And PA-12 went for about
$32.
Yeah, 1945. Well, anyway, Jakey says, now look. He says, I'll admit to you, he says, yeah, you're right about this New York telephone directory. These are people with deposits on airplanes. There's hundreds of them ahead of you. Why don't you deliver a few planes for the factory and wait till your number comes up? It sounded like a good deal. So I delivered 27 airplanes. I took two to Mexico and
Chihuahua.
Yeah, where the big old fat Mexican gals is making a tortilla. There, she pull her skirt up around about this high, get her big fat leg out there, get the cornmeal going, pitter-patter, and then she roll up some chopped coyote meat and pour a little torpedo juice over the top of it and toast it a while on a grill made out of a rock, and this was something to eat.
Yeah.
And the one breath would just curl your hair, and the second bite would almost petrify you. But I didn't take long to find out that Mexican style was not for me. Oh.
Yeah, I'm up all night.
Inedible.
I know. Well, I think you can eat that stuff all their life and, you know, never get ulcers.
Well, I'll tell you one thing.